Mr. Chairman, fellow students of the Brigham Young University, and friends of this great institution, we welcome you here at this homecoming affair. One of the original pioneers who entered Salt Lake Valley with Brigham Young on July 24, 1947, was a Mormon apostle by the name of Ezra Taft Benson. I am sure that even with his prophetic insight, it was not given him to know that 107 years later, his grandson would be the first member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to be made a member of the President's Cabinet. Secretary Benson, even in his educational career, has always believed in flexible and shifting supports. He first supported by his attendance the Oneida Stake Academy at Preston. Later, he attended and supported the Utah State Agricultural College. Finally, he attended and supported this institution, from which he graduated with honors in 1926. Continuing this principle of flexible and shifting responsibility, he then attended Iowa State College at Ames, from which he received his master's degree and was elected to the Honorary Society of Agriculture. Again being flexible, he later did graduate work at the University of California. His idea of agricultural flexibility is therefore one of long duration and not one concocted when he became Secretary of Agriculture. Because of his rugged days on the farm, when as a boy he took over the management of his father's farm while his father served on a mission, I think it is proper to read from an address which Mr. Justice Sutherland, an alumnus of this institution, gave to the graduating class of this university in 1941. Telling of his pioneer days and the situation prevalent at this university while Mr. Sutherland was a student, which I'm sure is characteristic of the boyhood days of Secretary Benson, Mr. Justice Sutherland said, "Nobody worried about child labor. The average boy of 10 worked and often worked very hard along with the other members to support his family. He milked, cut and carried in the night's wood, carried swill to the pigs, curried the horses, hoed the corn, guided the plow, or if not, followed it in the task of picking up potatoes which had been upturned while his young vertebra approached dislocation, and he was ready to consider a bid to surrender his hopes of salvation in exchange for the comfort of a hinge in the small of his back. There was never any scarcity of, or any surplus of food. Often there was a scarcity. No one thought of a bonus as a means of curtailing production, which indeed is comparatively a modern contrivance. At meals, the platter was licked clean. Nobody was wasted. And nothing was wasted. If anything went wrong with the internal organs, an overloaded stomach was the last thing suspected. Society was not divided into the idle rich and the worthy poor. There were no rich, idle, or otherwise. Everybody was poor and everybody worked. Neither the 8-hour day nor the 40-hour week had arrived. Work began when it was light enough to see and ended when it became too dark. Those who had candles to illuminate the supper table were fortunate. The light of a lamp was an exhibition of luxury. Among the people, there was discomfort, hardship, lack of medicines for the sick, and an absence of that variety of food now considered so necessary to health. Calories were ignored and vitamins were unknown." May I suggest that this quotation from Mr. Justice Sutherland should give Secretary Benson the best kind of text for a talk on good citizenship this evening. For he is here as a part of our homecoming, not to give us a political talk, but to enjoy with us the pleasure of visiting together in this great Republic of America. He has reserved his political talk for Salt Lake City tomorrow evening, to which you're all invited. May I suggest to you students that when Secretary Benson was a student here, he was voted the most popular man of his class and an honor student. We are proud that two of his sons have since graduated from this institution. They were also leaders on our campus. His daughter Barbara is our homecoming queen at this time. He has three other daughters who will someday be a part of the happy hunting ground at this university. We are grateful, Secretary Benson, that you did us the honor of coming to address us immediately after you were nominated for the position of Secretary of Agriculture. We are grateful also that you have done us the honor tonight of leaving a very busy schedule in this political campaign to address us at this homecoming. I therefore have the honor to present to you a Christian gentleman, a loving and a proud father, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, a member of the President's Cabinet, and one of our most distinguished alumni, Ezra Taft Benson.
President Wilkinson, members of the faculty, student body, and friends of this great institution, my fellow Americans, my heart is full of gratitude as I look into the faces of this vast audience and realize the unseen faces that may be listening in tonight. This is a signal honor and a truly great privilege to be here and talk to you informally about matters which are close to my heart and I'm sure are close to yours. I have no manuscript, but I would like to talk to you very frankly about some of the things that are vital to us as American citizens. The first public address I made following my call to serve in the cabinet of the president-elect was before the student body of this great institution. Back in December 1st, 1952. Much has happened since then. I went into the cabinet very much a stranger. The call had come on a very high spiritual plane, and when the president of the church indicated that his mind was clear, that he saw where my duty laid, I was, of course, willing and anxious to respond. I say I went into the cabinet somewhat of a stranger. I was unacquainted with the man whom the American people had elected to the high office of chief executive. I had never seen him. I had never heard his voice until the day that call came. And as an American from the outside, one of you going in, I'd simply like to say this by way of report, that I'm very grateful for what I found as an American, as a Latter-day Saint, as a citizen of this great state. I've been very pleased since that first cabinet meeting when I had the opportunity in response to the call of the president to lead that group in humble prayer to the Almighty. I'm grateful for the spirit of humility, the spirit of devotion, the spirit of dedication, which I have found as I have served. I wish I might take every American into a Friday morning cabinet meeting that you might feel of the spirit which is there, and also draw more closely to the man who has been elected to the highest office in this land. I hope and pray that the same spirit may always be in the leadership of this great country, regardless of the party which may be in power. Because after all, this nation has a spiritual foundation. And I'm so pleased that here at Brigham Young University, increased attention is being given to one of what I consider the three great objectives of this institution. First objective, I think, is to help to build real Latter-day Saints. Men and women who live according to the standards of the Church and Kingdom of God. Secondly, to train young men and women for honorable vocations and for life. And third, to teach the responsibilities of citizenship, the principles of Americanism, and to teach a love for the constitution of this land and the glorious concepts and principles embodied in that great document, and also to teach something of the prophetic history of this great nation and something of the fruits of our free enterprise system, all of which is coupled in this one thought, teaching the responsibilities of citizenship. And it's about this last objective that I'd like to say a few words tonight. I never travel across this great nation, but what I have a feeling of gratitude and thanksgiving for all that we have and are. As we came across the country this morning and noted its broad, fruitful farms, its humming factories, its gleaming cities, certainly it was easy to realize that we have achieved unequaled material progress in this great country. We have become the greatest, the richest nation under heaven. And we have done this with about 6% or 7% of the world's land area and about 7% of its people. And this fall we will harvest almost half of the total food and fiber of the world here in America. As a matter of fact, about half of the usable wealth in usable farm, is produced here in this land choice above all others. We have an ever-increasing array of comforts and beauties and blessings for man. During the last 100 years, our productivity has increased 1/5 every 10 years. Physical drudgery is almost unknown. Mechanization, the use of machines, has produced this unequaled record that today approximately 60% of the energy going into work in this country is produced by machines, about 1% by horses and about 3% by men. The average American worker has the equivalent of 99 mechanical slaves working for him daily. The average American worker today produces 6 times as much per man hour as he did in 1850. Yes, this is a great country. And certainly this greatness was foreshadowed and foreseen by ancient prophets who lived here. I'll not take time to recount those revelations, those prophecies made by the brother of Jared, by Lehi, by Jacob, and by Nephi of old. Yes, this nation has a prophetic history. All of the great events that have transpired here were foreseen by ancient prophets, the coming of Columbus included, the coming of the Pilgrim Fathers. It was predicted that they would prosper here, that they would humble themselves before the Almighty, that the power of God would be with them, and that this nation would move forward to its great destiny. And when the founding fathers came, they truly came with that spirit of humility. They were God-fearing, humble people. Bradford records in the official record about those early arrivals on these shores. Being thus arrived in good harbor, he states, and brought safe to land, they fell upon their knees and blessed the God of heaven. That was their first official act. The impelling force in their hearts was a love for the basic ideals and principles which were a part of their very lives. In fact, these were dearer to them than life itself. These basic principles of freedom, industry, thrift, decency, honor, and a love of God. It was a high-minded way in which this nation began. The rules of conduct were taken from the Decalogue, from the Bible, from the Gospel, from the Scriptures. They honored a sacred Sabbath. They maintained other high standards. They frowned upon profanity and other vices. They prohibited gambling. They encouraged people not to keep bad company, to repeat no grievances. They emphasized the spiritual virtues. And many years later, when the nation was founded, Washington echoing the feeling of the early Pilgrim fathers and others who had come from abroad, acknowledged God's direction and the importance of spirituality in the lives of our people and in this great country, when he said in these words, "No people can be found to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than the people of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced to the character of an independent nation seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency." And then as to the place of religion and morality, the father of our country continued, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." His successor spoke in similar vein. But then later, when a great modern prophet came upon the scene, he threw even greater light upon these basic principles and ideals when he pointed out as an instrument of the Almighty that the Constitution of this land was established by men whom the God of heaven raised up unto that very purpose. He pointed out very clearly in those early revelations that it is not right for man to be in bondage one to another. But as we contemplate the rich promises that have been made in the prophetic history of this country and the direction of divine providence in the affairs of this nation to date, we might well ask the question, what of the future? We have enjoyed divine favor, but what does the future hold for us? One great British statesman some 2 years ago said that the United States will go the way of Rome. One of our newscasters 2 years ago made this significant comment. He says, "The history of Rome could be written on the front page and passed off as today's news. We are trying to buy away the shadows, so morally bankrupt ourselves that we cannot lead by example. We try to bribe the world with dollars, forcing funds and guns on reluctant friends, because we are afraid, like the alcoholic who drinks on a cold day to keep warm and on a warm day to cool off, and then drinks when he's unhappy to forget, and when he's happy, it's to celebrate. Anything to dodge the humiliating truth that he is afraid." On that last night in the upper room, said this commentator, the master said, "Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." Then he goes on to say, "Yes, we have worked hard. We have prospered greatly and we have grown fat. We've quit work. We felt insecure and we've become afraid." And then he continues further, "Here you and I sit with all the charts and maps of the past pointing out the right roads and the wrong ones. And we, instead of going straight ahead, have to keep turning left, following the same dizzy circle that led these ghost empires of the past into ignominious oblivion. Only we're going there at 600 miles an hour. There is not one political candidate on the horizon who dares to tell the whole truth tonight. Not one, because the truth is work or perish. And that is not a very inviting campaign promise. The businessman is at war with himself. He wants overseas spending to perpetuate the bull market, but objects to the high taxes it costs. The farmer objects to federal spending, but not to accepting part of it. The worker making a tank for Korea says a prayer for the boys who will use it, then strikes for higher wages before it is finished. We all want to buy wholesale and sell retail." And then he concludes by saying, "We cannot expect good manners from our children if they never see any in us. We cannot sell honor and dignity and decency to the rest of the world if we don't have any? Well, that's probably an extreme statement, but there is a seed of truth in it. Nations tend to sow the seeds of their own destruction. If we can rely on history, oftentimes while enjoying great prosperity, while enjoying high standards of living, high income, good business activity, history reveals very clearly, it seems to me, that rarely is a great civilization conquered from without until it has in some way weakened or destroyed itself from within. Some of you may have read, as I have recently, some of those great volumes by Will Durant as a part of the story of civilization. A monumental work, Volume 3, impressed me very deeply. It's entitled Caesar and Christ, and records the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, the coming of Christianity. It covers the period from 800 B.C. to 325 A.D., a period of 1,125 years. And in the last chapter of that great volume of 600 pages is one chapter, the epilogue, in which he tries to point out from what history reveals why this great empire failed, why it fell. And these are the major reasons. I wish you'd note them carefully, and as you do so, try and determine in your own mind if there's anything in evidence in our own country which smacks of these causes which this historian claims were at the foundation of the fall of the great Roman Empire. The first cause he gives, or group of causes, he lists as biological and most fundamental. And it started with the breakdown of the home and the family, the limitation of children, the refusal to assume the obligations of honorable parenthood. And he says it began with the educated classes, the deferment and avoidance of marriage. Sexual excesses were indulged in outside the marriage covenant. The operation of contraception and abortion became common. Reduced fertility resulted. Sex ran riot, and moral decay resulted. Secondly, he mentions the waste of natural resources, mining, deforestation, erosion, neglect of irrigation canals, but most important, the negligence of harassed and discouraged men, the failure to teach high moral principles to the youth of the land, those principles which make for the building of character, the neglect of our greatest single asset, our boys and girls. And thirdly, the rising costs of government, armies, doles, public works, expanding bureaucracy, a parasitic court, depreciation of the currency. I'm sure that all of us as Americans must be grateful that this trend toward greater and greater expense of our federal government has at least been changed a bit in direction. And I pay tribute to the men in both political parties who have helped to bring about a reduction of $11 billion in federal spending in the past few months, without weakening our defense and our foreign relations. The mandate came from the people. We had gone too far in the other direction in the rising costs of government. And the matter of bureaucracy, expanding bureaucracy. Of course, we want the necessary number of people on the federal payroll to perform the services which are necessary and needed. But 216,000 have left the federal payroll in the last few months. And any time we have people on the federal payroll that are not needed, it's an economic waste. And after all, as American citizens, we have only what we produce. And when people are engaged in any service which is not needed, it tends to reduce by that much the things we have to enjoy in this country. expanding bureaucracy, a parasitic court, depreciation of the currency. And we've gone a long way in that direction. I'm very pleased to see the stability we have now in the value of the dollar, which had depreciated substantially over a period of years, until, as a matter of fact, it was worth only 38 cents compared with the 1913 dollar, and about half as much as the 1935-39 dollar. And then he goes on, absorption of investment capital by confiscatory taxation, inflation, which nullified trust funds and charitable foundations, pensions, savings, and old age benefits. And surely it should be gratifying to every American today, too, to note that during the past few months it's been possible to cut the taxes of this great country by $7.4 billion. But $4.5 billion of that, the benefits have gone to the individuals, which represents about $45 per capita or $180 per family. And the balance has gone to the corporations, a savings in taxes to the corporations. Yes, we were following this trend of increasing and increasing taxes and the centralization of those funds in the federal government, which has in it real danger. And I'm very happy to see, and I believe every American is, a trend towards the expenditure of a larger proportion of our tax funds at home, in the states, in the communities, in the counties, where I think the people have greater wisdom to spend them and spend them wisely than those of us who represent, than those who represent us in Washington. And the fact remains also that the dollar, the Utah dollar, cannot make the round trip to Washington and back without a bureaucratic bite being taken out of it. And so I'm happy to see this change in trend toward greater use of our funds at home. I think it'll result in benefits to all of us in the long run. And then Durant mentions a fifth one. He says the political causes came largely from centralization of control in the federal government. The increasing despotism and control by the state destroyed the citizen's civic sense and dried up statesmanship at its source. And yet I believe that history records that Rome has had no rival in the art of government. It certainly achieved a democracy of free men and then destroyed it with corruption and violence. And so we need to reflect on history and compare some of the trends of those days with some of the things that are in evidence here in our own country. I often wonder what our pioneer fathers and the founders of this nation would say if they were here today. I feel that probably they would recognize that some of our liberties have already been abridged, that too many of us are inclined to call on Washington to do for us many of the things that we should do and can do for ourselves. I've often said there are three tests we ought to apply when we're considering asking our great federal government to perform any service for us as taxpayers, as citizens, as members of that great government. First of all, assuming that the service is needed, can the government do it more efficiently than it can be done locally or on a state level by some private agency? Generally speaking, the services rendered by the federal government are not most efficient. There's no profit motive. There's no competition there, which is the very life of business, and that tends toward inefficiency. And then secondly, I think we should ask the question, how will it affect the morale and the character of the people if this or that service is performed by the central government? How will it affect our free institutions, the home, the school, the church, and our other institutions? In other words, I think they take a very good look at this question of freedom today and whether or not we are tending to weaken our hold on it. Of course, the founding fathers did not invent this priceless boon of individual freedom and respect for the dignity of man. That great gift to mankind sprang from the Creator and not from government. But the founding fathers, with superb genius, I believe, welded together certain safeguards which we must, to the very limit, protect always if we would preserve the blessings of freedom. They found it necessary to turn to religion and to the Scriptures in order to make their new experiments make sense. But they were guided by allegiance to basic principles. And these principles must be kept in mind always by those of us who are here today and reaping the benefits and the blessings which they so wisely provided. We must be careful that we do not trade freedom for security. Whenever that's attempted, usually we lose both. There's always a tendency when nations become mature for the people to become more interested in preserving their luxuries and their comforts than in safeguarding the ideals and principles which made these comforts and luxuries possible. And so today, I think it's very important, as American citizens interested in the future welfare of this country and in safeguarding these great basic concepts that have made this nation great, that we give serious consideration to our responsibility as citizens in electing men to office who believe in these great principles and who will defend them courageously, vigorously, on all occasions. Wise man, good man, honest man, as the God of heaven has pointed out in the Revelations. I mentioned in a recent general conference of the church that as Latter-day Saints particularly, we have four important guides that we should use in checking any proposed policy or program or idea that's offered. First of all, is it right as measured by the basic principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the principles of righteousness? Secondly, is it right as measured by the basic principles embodied in the Constitution and our Bill of Rights? And thirdly, is it right as measured by the counsel and the direction and the admonitions of the living oracles whom God has appointed? And fourthly, is it right as measured by its effect or their effect upon the morale and the character of the people of this great country? I think we need to look for the answers to the decline in this country in public morals. And I'm sure if we look very closely, these are some of the reasons we'll find. I think we'll find that there's evidence in high and in low places of a weakness, a vacillating leadership. And it's not confined to any one party. Too much effort, too much action based on expediency, and not enough on principle, eternal principles, which lay at the very foundation of all we hold dear as a great Christian nation. The alarming growth of a something-for-nothing attitude on the part of many of our people. I think we're all more or less guilty of it. The failure of us to stand on our own feet and to shoulder the responsibilities which are ours as citizens. Bad examples by unscrupulous politicians and also by delinquent parents. A weakening of religious training. a substitution of faith in a destroying materialism. These are some of the causes. There are many others. Some of the weaknesses. Some of the things that we need to give attention to. And we must also keep in mind, in my humble judgment, that economics and morals are both parts of one inseparable body of truth. And these must be in harmony. And we must square our actions and our policies with these eternal principles if this nation would be preserved and not go the way of Rome and other dead civilizations. If we would enjoy the fulfillment of the promises which have been made by the prophets, ancient and modern, regarding this great land. There is a force, my fellow Americans, in the universe which no mortal can alter. And we need to see to it that our policies and our programs conform with those eternal principles which have been set forth by that force, by the God of heaven. In other words, we need to raise our sights beyond the dollar sign, beyond material things. We need to recognize that America has become a great nation because she has adhered wholeheartedly to certain basic Christian principles that are eternal. And that we must have an adherence to these high moral principles, these spiritual principles, if this nation would endure. And God grant that it may endure. We need this faith. We need this interest in the affairs of this great nation, politically and economically. We need this adherence to these principles. And as President Wilson said some years ago, our civilization cannot survive materially unless in some way it is redeemed spiritually. And so we need an understanding of these fundamentals. And we need a rededication to their preservation. And this needs to come in the schools, in the communities, in the states, in our homes. We must not take our blessings for granted as American citizens. Truly, we enjoy the richest blessings of any people under heaven. These blessings have come largely because we have in the past in large measure adhered to these basic fundamental concepts and principles. It is my hope and prayer that in the days ahead we will have a more devoted and wholehearted adherence to these same basic principles and concepts. We must keep America strong. We must keep America sound economically, socially, and above all spiritually. God grant it may be so, I humbly pray. Thank you very much.